Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. If you have any questions or comments about Current State, you can always email us at currentstate@wkar.org. Or if you'd like to join in on the conversation, follow us on Twitter at @KARCurrentState.
Welcome back to Current State and happy Fat Tuesday. Joyeux Mardi Gras. Everybody in the WKAR News Department has Scott Pohl to thank for the punchkis every year. It's a tradition, and I have a custard punchki waiting for me in an hour. Thank you, Scott. And in keeping with the season here, music from New Orleans spread throughout today's Current State. We got the Meters and we got Louis Armstrong and a bunch of others, so that should be fun. We should also, from the outset here, I think, congratulate whoever it was that first unearthed the fact that tonight's Michigan State-Michigan game is the first one with both teams in the national top 10. First ever. That sounds as if maybe a little bit of detective work went into that, and it's the perfect nugget of information to put tonight's game into context, I think. Here's Spartan head coach Tom Izzo.
I think it's fun to actually feel like the game matters in every way, shape, or form, both locally and nationally. And I'm not sure that's happened since I've been here. Two top 10 teams. I mean, how often has that happened here in ever? Surprise, surprise.
9 p.m. tip on ESPN. Go Green. About a year ago, Lansing voters approved a proposal to sell the 120-acre Waverly Golf Course, along with an adjacent park, Michigan Avenue Park. Last night, the Lansing City Council considered the next step, a formal decision to sell the land. That proposal passed unanimously, by the way, last night. And here to discuss what all that means, along with the bigger picture involving all that park and green space on Lansing's west side, is Lansing City Councilman Brian Jeffries, who heads the Council's Planning and Development Committee. Welcome back, Brian.
Thank you for having me.
And Kathy Rogers is the Lansing Township Supervisor. Welcome to Current State, Kathy.
Thank you very much.
I wonder if each of you could give our listeners just a brief history on how these two parks, Waverly and Michigan Avenue, came to be considered for sale in the first place. How did we get to this place?
Well, at least from the city side of things, back in 2007, I believe it was, the park at that time was a golf course. And the mayor, due to certain budget constraints, shut down the operations of the golf course. And for the last 5-6 years, it's just been, you know, in the current state that it is. And once or twice a year, someone will go out and actually mow it and row it in terms of creating hay bales out there, if you go out there and you can see that. And so we've had discussions over the years as to what use the city could put the property and kind of repurpose it. And there have been some activities in terms of events that occur from time to time out there, but really no real use to the city in a very specific way. And what we did last night, it's called an Act 33 review. The city actually, through the park board process as well as city council, will review the property to see if there is any continued use or purpose for the city, or is it surplus property. And if so, we will put it out for what's called a market for sale. And what we did last night was pass a resolution that authorized the administration to actually put it up for sale. They could either go stick a sign out there that says for sale, or they could hire a broker to do that, or they could go through a similar process that we did with the Red Cedar Golf Course in that park. And that's, you know, do an RFP process where we put some ideas together, some just very broad guidelines, and then send them out to developers, not only locally but across the country, to see what kind of ideas can come back for the sale of that property.
And are those literally the three options, the primary options that rise to the top?
At this, a
sale, a broker, or an RFP?
Correct. Okay. That's what we're looking at.
And Kathy Rogers, explain how it is the City of Lansing and Lansing Township are both involved in this property.
Well, the Waverly Golf Course, which is how we know it, it's the Waverly Park, actually is owned by the City of Lansing. The City of Lansing bought it in 1939 for $40,000. It was 120 acres total. And they developed that as a recreational spot. It is not in the City of Lansing. It was purchased by the City of Lansing, but it is in Lansing Township. So the township is definitely interested in any buyer for that property from the city, because we will be the community that will handle site plan review, how that's going to be handled in terms of zoning, what kinds of things are going to be allowed to go into that zoning, which will depend a lot on what the infrastructure in that park is for stormwater, for sanitary sewer, for water. We already are the responsible unit of government for fire protection and police protection in that park,
okay,
because it exists in Lansing Township. For instance, we had several calls for fires in the hay bales last summer.
Oh.
So we are very interested in working with the city in how they are going to market it and who's going to end up getting that property.
And ultimately, Brian Jeffries, from the city's perspective, this is a lot about a revenue crunch, isn't it? I mean, it just isn't tenable anymore for the City of Lansing to be in the golf course business, or do I have that wrong?
Well, we do have a budget situation. This does provide an opportunity for the city in terms of some revenue coming in. We do not have any appraisals yet on the property in terms of being able to talk about numbers. But I think as we move forward, as what Kathy has said is absolutely true, I hope there is discussions that are currently or will start shortly between the administration and Lansing Township in terms of what the township has an interest in. It would be a waste of time, I believe, if we go through this process, bring a development forward that is something that the township cannot accept, since they do have control over zoning in that area. Right now, it's currently zoned residential. That's the only use that property can be put to. So if there's something other than residential that's going to go in there, the township is certainly going to have a lot of say in that. The second piece is for us on the budget side. This is not located in the city. This would be a one lump sum of money coming to us in terms of the sale proceeds. The other thing I would like to discuss with the township is the possibility of a 425 tax sharing arrangement. We have a number of agreements in the regions with Aladdin Township and Delta Township where we've gone in and helped provide some of the infrastructure that has gone in and paid for those. And in return, we ask for a return on that investment through the tax capture that the township will get and share those tax returns. So we would have an ongoing stream of revenue, not just the one-time lump sum that would come in on the sale price, but some ongoing tax revenue that's coming in. I hope that discussion also occurs at the same time.
You confident about that, Kathy Rogers, from your perspective?
We've not discussed a 425 in regard to this property.
Okay.
We've never. I'm talking about in-house. In Lansing Township, we've never discussed
right.
that. The reason that we haven't is there is not a lot of infrastructure that we need from the city. Already the city owns, maintains, and operates the sanitary sewers in Lansing Township, so it would just be an extension for that. We have Westside Water that would provide water to any development there. We have our own water department that would provide that. And Lansing Township has already paid for and continues to pay for any storm water. The city did get an assessment for part of the drainage district that is there, but they refused to pay it, so Lansing Township picked that up. So we actually... that was back in the 1970s, and they were going to pick up their percentage of cost on that drain, and City Council, long before Brian Jeffries was there or anybody in city government now was there, said, no, we're not going to pay that. We don't think that we have to, and they didn't.
Thanks for clarifying that.
And therefore, Lansing Township picked up that entire drain assessment on the Waverly Golf Course.
Is that going to be an issue moving forward, though?
It should not be. Okay. I bring that in just as history of, in terms of doing a 425, the person you're doing the 425 with has to have something that they can offer you that you don't have.
Got it.
We have water, we have sewer, and we've already paid for the drains. So there's not a lot that the city can say to Lansing Township, oh, there's something we can really do for you in a 425. I'm not saying that that can't be a discussion, and I think it needs to be, because there are only certain economic vehicles that are available to local government, both municipals and townships. And I think we need to take advantage of anything that is out there that we might be able to take advantage of in terms of funding and in terms of sharing. And it definitely meets the definition of working together for regionalism.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have a huge amount of property just east of the Waverly Golf Course that is 57 acres in the city and 167 acres in the township, in which we are going to have to work together and are working together through our planning departments, through LEAP, and that's the GM properties on West Saginaw Street. So this is all in the same area. This is an area of the Saginaw Corridor Authority, which was supposed to get off the ground and hasn't yet, but we hope that it will, because all of this land, the Waverly Golf Course included, going from Saginaw Street from the city, from the township's borders into the city of Lansing, is going to include an immense amount of acreage, and the two units of government, along with LEAP and any other regional partner that would like to get involved in this, we need to be talking.
We're talking with Brian Jeffries of the Lansing City Council and Kathy Rogers, the Lansing Township Supervisor. Brian, are we about to enter a period of really creative bargaining, creative negotiations here?
Well, I think there's certainly an opportunity there, and I think Kathy was right. There are certain things that municipalities can bring forward in terms of its economic development toolbox, and, for example, personal property exemptions and things like that that we have entered into in terms of tax sharing arrangements with other municipalities such as Delta Township and the GM plants. It affords, if we're going to do something manufacturing, if we're talking about the old GM property, it affords the ability for a manufacturer to come in if they want to bring in $10 million worth of equipment, at least to get a tax abatement on the personal property taxes that may attach to that equipment. Those are tax sharing arrangements and agreements that that we can enter into, and I think this does present a good opportunity to be very creative in terms of what we do, not only with the Waverly site, and that's 120 acres. It's a green site. It's not a brownfield. It's ready for development. The contours are such that I think it really presents some very interesting aspects and opportunities. But then when you look at the old GM site, which is a huge brownfield, we do have some monies that are available that we got, or that are available through the bankruptcy that the GM went through, and that have been set aside for the cleanup, but that's going to take, I think, some real cooperation in terms of not only putting the deal together, but actually going out there and selling the piece. If you've been out there, this is going to be a huge effort to clean up, just to get it ready for development, and therefore to be competitive with the surrounding townships in terms of bringing in a major, I would think, they're a manufacturing group.
The property right now only has to be remediated to industrial. So there's going to be a lot of cleanup that will take place by a developer after Racer Trust, which is the entity that is actually has the money and is cleaning up the property. So if we want to do anything other than manufacturing on that property, if a developer wants to do anything other than manufacturing, there's going to be another level of environmental cleanup that's going to have to take place on that property, because GM is only required to take it to industrial. So that's out there. And right now, LEAP has organized a subcommittee, which I sit on, and Matt Brinkley, our senior planner, sits on, that we are talking with the City of Lansing. There are representatives of the City of Lansing on that committee, Lansing Township, Racer Trust, and leadership in LEAP that sits on that committee. And we are talking all the time about how do we cooperate, how do we make this land viable again. It sits right in the middle of our communities.
Do you anticipate a lot of zoning changes for all of these properties?
For Waverly, I really don't see that being residential. There's not a lot of call for residential in that area. But there certainly could be. It's really a unique opportunity to take maybe the frontage on Saginaw Street and zone that commercial. And I'm just throwing these out as ideas. Our planning commission would have those zoning recommendations would have to come from them and have to be applied for by the person who bought the property. But it is a unique opportunity to have maybe some commercial development that fronts Saginaw Street and then some recreational on Michigan Avenue where the park is because there's the sledding hill. There used to be baseball fields there. Soccer's now big now. Instead of baseball, maybe you could do a soccer field. Maybe you could combine a commercial area in which some of the taxes coming off of that commercial area could support the recreational area, and maybe Lansing Township, Ingham County could form a task force to make that a go-to place for recreation, for winter recreation and other uses.
None of these areas are 425 zones right now.
No.
Revenue share. Now, can you create a new 425 zone?
You can always,
with the areas we're talking about.
You sure. Always can create a 425. That it's a powerful tool for units of government to act in cooperative ways with one another. And you can make the criteria of that 425 anything that those two units of government want it to be. There is no set criteria. You know, well, in 30 years after this happens, it'll go to the city of Lansing, or 30 years it'll go to Lansing Township. Or you can make it anything that you want the units of government.
Very good. We're out of time. We've got. I'm so
Thank
sorry.
You.
We could go a while longer. Kathy Rogers is the Lansing Township Supervisor. Brian Jeffries sits on the Lansing City Council. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much.
It's Current State on WKAR. There's a jazzy celebration in town this Friday night from the MSU College of Music. MSU Director of Jazz Studies Rodney Whitaker and the professors of jazz play in Cook Recital Hall in the MSU Music Building starting at 8. And oh yeah, it's Rodney Whitaker's birthday, too. WKAR's Melissa Benmark spoke with Whitaker about the milestone.
Well, you know, this is actually my 45th birthday celebration. I had a 40th birthday concert, and we had such a good time. And originally, you know, I set it out as like sort of a birthday celebration, and then I retracted, but I had already submitted, so they went with the idea. So it'll be a lot of fun. I'll just tell some stories and have a good time musically. So, and it's great to get an opportunity to celebrate my birthday with the community, but also to celebrate it with my members of the professors of jazz.
Well, you have to be our age to know about having a record birthday. The previous record birthday that you had was 33 and a third, and the next one would be 78, right? So 45?
That's funny. Wow, 45. That is quite remarkable.
Do you remember your first 45?
My first 45? Yeah, my first one was that I actually purchased was Donny Hathaway's This Christmas.
Very special Christmas for me.
I think I was 14. I heard it on the radio, and I ran out and bought my first 45.
So what will you and the other professors of jazz be playing?
Well, we're going to play, you know, we have a new CD out called Better Than All Right, and we will play selections from them. You know, we're jazz musicians, so we wait till the last minute to decide our repertoire.
What do you think is the most important in rehearsing in terms of feeling what other people are doing in your band? Is it a real visual thing, or is it more of a sound thing?
Yes, is the answer. It's visual. And rehearsing is interesting for us because, you know, jazz players, we talk a lot about feeling. And so when we rehearse, you know, of course, we're trying to hone the notes and that sort of thing and perfect the parts. But sometimes it's really about just getting a feel for what the music is going to be like, because it often changes. And sometimes, even though we have written parts, we change the notes, or we change the phrasing, or we change something. So it's really about getting the feel for what might happen, and you can't really predict. And that's the beauty of jazz.
You must have to know each other well enough to know how far is too far to go in terms of throwing the other players a curve.
Well, there's no such thing as how far to going too far with jazz. I mean, one of the things is we've all listened to the music. I mean, it is a rare music that the whole recorded history of the music is recorded. You know, so for example, we all have reference points. So generally, when you're improvising, you know, you don't come out of nowhere with something. There's, you know, you've heard someone do something before, and there's all these quotes and things that people have already played. And so we have that as a reference point. But there's no such thing as how far to go. You know, you can go as far as you want to go. That's the beauty of jazz.
This new CD, is it originals or not originals, or what kind of songs are on it?
Actually, the new CD is a two CD set. Actually, of music that we recorded, we had a commission a couple years ago from the Greater Lansing Arts Council where we had a piece called Spanish Tinge that Diego Rivera wrote. Etienne Charles wrote Jazz in the Caribbean, and I wrote a piece called Jazz Up South about the African-American migration. And then Reggie Thomas, who just came on to faculty, wrote several new pieces. I'd probably say almost every tune is an original tune, except we have one standard that I arranged featuring our guitarist, Perry Hughes. But it's all original music, and for those interested, it's available on shop.msu.
Since we're observing a birthday, do you remember what the earliest age was that you started listening to jazz, or maybe got your first jazz record?
I first began listening to jazz at 13, and I figured a year that I have to do the math. But my first jazz LP, I think I was in eighth grade. And I was coming home from school, and one of my neighbors saw me carrying an upright bass. I had just started playing bass. So it had to be September, sometime like that. And he almost broke his leg, tripping down the steps to run and give me two jazz albums. And the two albums were John Coltrane's Soul Train, is the name of the record. And the second one is Miles Davis' Seven Steps to Heaven. Let me know that both bass players on the record, both Paul Chambers and Ron Carter, were from Detroit, and they both went to Cass Tech. And so he said, so that for me, that gave me sort of like a legacy. I'm a part of something. So that was the first day I wanted to be a jazz musician.
It's a pretty young age to figure that out. I wonder sometimes, because the one thing that every musician, regardless of what kind of music they play, always says is that there was someone in their life who, you know, in our old age played records for us.
Oh yeah.
And because everybody wears headphones these days, I mean, I know I hate to sound like young kids today, but I wonder sometimes if people share music the way we used to when we were kids, or our friends used to share music with us, or some parent or older person used to share music with us. I mean, I guess concerns me, just because it seems like so much of music is people sharing and turning each other onto it.
Well, I think the challenge of the time is that they share music in a different way, but it's not as interactive as it was when we grew up. And what we did here a couple years ago in the jazz program, our mantra is, you can't listen to music by yourself. And that's because the thing that goes along, I mean, if I give you access to my files, you can look at what I'm listening to and sort of check it out, but then you don't get the stories that I'm telling you while I'm telling you about this music. Because there may be a story behind why I like this song, or some story about the music or the making of the music that students are missing out on. So a couple years ago we said, well, you need to listen together. You guys need to get together and have listening parties. And so a lot of the students are starting to do that, and they realize the value of it. But I think in this time, people are sharing music and probably sharing more music than we did, but they're missing the point. The reason why I'm in love with jazz is not just because of the music, but it's also a documentation. I can go back and track who turned me on to this particular song. And it's a way of keeping the memories of all those people that I had an opportunity to be mentored by.
That was MSU Director of Jazz Studies Rodney Whitaker with Melissa Benmark. It's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Joyeux Mardi Gras. Have a punchki. Just don't have nine, okay? Alabama in the 1960s was at the heart of the civil rights movement, the bus boycotts, the marches, the sit-ins, snarling dogs, gushing fire hoses. Many of that era's iconic moments happened in Alabama. Under the leadership of Whitney Young, the National Urban League, which is one of our country's oldest civil rights organizations, joined the NAACP, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and others in the fight to end Jim Crow segregation in the Deep South. Our guests today were dispatched by Mr. Young to open an Urban League office in Birmingham, Alabama, and they join us to share their memories. On the phone from Chicago, Clarence Wood. He's the former founding director of the Birmingham Urban League, and most recently was executive director of the Jane Addams Hull House. And with me in the studio is Willard Walker, who is Clarence's deputy director in Birmingham. Mr. Walker's gone on to have a long career in public service and government here in Michigan. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
To remind our listeners, please, each of you, what the Urban League's main mission was in Alabama in the mid-1960s. Clarence Wood?
Our main mission was to make sure that the laws that had been passed, the new achievements growing out of the civil rights movement, were made real to the people who had been, until that time, discriminated against and segregated. And so we went in to assure that employment was made possible, that people were able to have access to those facilities that in the past they had not had access to, from bathrooms to water fountains to front doors. So that was what we were sent to do, was to actualize the successes of the civil rights movement.
Willard Walker, how did you experience that?
When we got there, we had a snapshot of what the city was like. Clarence is from Birmingham. And I grew up in Columbus, Georgia, so we knew what we were up against. And we also knew that we had to get a staff that was well prepared to go out in that community and do the work that Clarence just described. And we did focus on employment, but we also focused on community organizing. We focused on integrating public facilities, as Clarence says. And we were, I believe, a Alabama-wide Urban League, so we weren't just Birmingham, but we could work all over the state to do this work. And the way we looked at it was one day at a time. We had to take it one day at a time. We had to identify what strategies we wanted to use. We had to communicate with each other all the time. We got to know each other very well.
Clarence Wood, there must have been days you took it 1 hour at a time, I imagine.
Well, of course. We didn't know what we were going to encounter every morning when we got up. There were those people who did not want us in the town. There were business leaders who would have preferred that we not come and challenge them and the practices of their businesses to that time, particularly retail store owners, restaurants, and major corporations from U.S. Steel to ACIPCO to the Stockholm plants that were there. Churches were not anxious to see us come. It could have meant that we would sit in the pew at the church that was downtown that had never had a black in it, rather than going to what, until that time, had been the church of the same denomination, but for the black community. And so there were numbers of people who did not necessarily want us there or expect us to proceed with a challenge that we had been given to do the kind of work that we were asked to do.
Willard, you mentioned that you saw the Birmingham office as a statewide kind of thing. Was there any less resistance in the city compared to the rural areas?
I think the city was more prepared to strategize against us than any of the rural areas. The rural areas were just a little bit, in my view, more dangerous simply because the people were feeling really, really, really threatened in the rural areas, even around Birmingham, but certainly in South and North Alabama. They hadn't seen had never been threatened by black people. And to hear about this organization and then to see, in most cases, just Clarence and myself coming into places, speaking to groups of people at rallies, visiting schools, visiting bombed out churches and that kind of thing, mm-hmm. they were really, really, really sort of thrown off. And so the dangers were outside. I think the people in Birmingham, because they've been at it for a long, long time, they got a little bit less, if I can say, offensive.
Clarence Wood, how did you become aware of Willard?
Oh, well. I had gone to college with a great group of folk who had all moved to Chicago. And when we arrived in Chicago, we met Willard and a group of others who all of us in one way or another began to work together. Willard and myself became fast friends. I had been working at the Department of Public Welfare in Chicago, and I was the first African-American to go to work for the Jewish community centers on the south side of Chicago.
Hmm.
And got Willard involved in my work there, so I'd known him professionally. And I needed someone who was willing to take the risks with me to go to Alabama, and I knew he had some reasons that he might be interested in going. So we had become friends. We had talked often about the South and our strong feelings and the draw that we had always about going back. We went every Christmas and on special holidays together. He was an easy target. I knew he wanted a little bit more money than he was making teaching school. I knew he had family in Birmingham. He was, as I said, an easy target, ready to go. I didn't want to tell him too much of what we were going for because it might have meant that he would not be willing to take some of the risks. Let me make one point on what Willard had said earlier. And what most people don't understand about the civil rights movement in the 60s period. And that was the laws were put on the books. We had new housing laws and new voting laws, and we had laws that let us sit differently on buses. Testing those laws was really critical at the time, particularly in the South. People were still afraid. They remembered the dogs. They remembered the Billy Clubs. They remembered Bull Connor. They remembered Lester Maddox. And I don't know that Willard and myself really thought about it, but we had been out of the South long enough to have enjoyed some of the freedoms that were available to us, eating in restaurants and going to places that we would not have been able to do had we been in the South. And so going back for us meant that we were usually doing the things that had become normal to us in Chicago. And people would see us able and willing to do those things. And so we were changing behavior in accordance with laws, but being examples to the people that these things could be done. And Willard can tell you the story. I remember the day we went into a department store and tried on a hat and asked to put on some shoes. It was long after the law had been passed that we had access to that, but that the salespeople still did not believe we had the right to do it. And so our behavior made a difference in the lives of those people that we worked with and for in the Birmingham Urban League.
How much resistance did you face in situations like that, Willard?
Well, we faced different resistance depending on what business we were in.
Uh-huh.
There, it was a matter of trying on a hat and saying, you do sell a lot of hats to black people here, and we know this because we did the research. And we also know you've got a lot of black people working here who are seamstresses and who help prepare the clothes, and so we can look at that. On the other hand, when we went to the steel mills, it was a different environment. And particularly when we talked to union guys, they had virtually a dual union system at U.S. Steel at that time, and most people don't believe that. I came here to go to the School of Labor and Industrial Relations, and I don't believe my professors believe that now. But the fact is they did, and we threatened that. We threatened it by showing up. We threatened it by asking questions about power and authority in the unions and what we thought it should be and what it really was. And so we had different levels of resistance, if you will, depending on the companies or the industry that we were talking about at the time. Clarence mentioned restaurants, huge businesses in the South, and they had some funny practices also. When we first went to New Orleans for a national convention, the practice of white waitresses watching black waiters and waitresses serve the table and then clean the table, and then white waitresses coming up or waiters coming up to get the tip, we found that to be quite different and actually sort of said to the restaurant, we're not going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they didn't run us out of town, but it was just a different behavior. And the people who that affected were really the people who worked in that industry, okay? And so it was different. And different challenges depending on where you were and what industry you went to.
Clarence Wood, what were the most alarming circumstances you ever found yourself in?
Oh, there were numbers. Driving from Birmingham to Montgomery, knowing that as we went under overpasses, there were people with guns having brick thrown down at your car as you passed under. And people would say, well, how did they know you were coming? Well, it was easy. You know, people would get your schedule, they knew where you were going, and they wanted to threaten you. And so those were difficult moments that way. Before Willard came to town, and I'll never forgive him for this, I went about 3 months before Willard did to Birmingham. As the executive director, I went to get the budget and to do all of the things that I had been assigned to do with the expectation that Willard would come at the end of the school year. I remember the day I pulled up in front of the office to get out of my car, and I remember the day someone put a gun to my head and said, you're not wanted here, you ought to leave town. And so I was threatened. I remember the phone calls that came to my house, and Willard's family reported numbers of phone calls that came to his house threatening our families and threatening us. My mother was a school teacher in Birmingham, and I remember my mother calling me one day and saying Hank had notified her that if her son continued to do some of the things that he was doing, she might find it difficult to continue with that bank and continue with her mortgage. And so there were threats all of the time. What we understood, though, was that there were people who we could go to who could understand the fear that we had and would help us by making the appropriate phone calls. And we had good board members who could do that. We had people who knew the way through the system to make those contacts.
You had to network. You were the first networkers.
Well, networkers, we were brokers in numbers of ways between the differences of thought in the community to advance a different kind of thinking. The Birmingham newspapers, special columns that were written for blacks, by blacks. When we went to the newspaper to say, it doesn't seem logical to continue two different pages of weddings every week, a page for blacks who were getting married, a page for whites who were getting married. Willard will remember the head of the newspaper, who had been a Klansman for a very long time, saying to us that he did not agree with what we were doing, and that in numbers of ways he was going to work to get us put out of the city. I remember our first meeting, and Willard is better at this one than I am, with the governor of Alabama, Governor Brewer, who read the Bible to Willard about why he should not expect to be equal.
Willard Walker, you want to add anything to that? Your recollection is as vivid as Clarence's.
Never has been. But the fact is that we were put under a certain amount of pressure every day. And when we went to talk to the governor in the case that Clarence is speaking of, they kept us waiting a long time, and that was fine. We didn't have anything else to do. But we got the audience, which was not typical, and the governor did take some time to tell us boys that if we didn't like what was going on in Alabama, he'd be pleased, you know, if we just go back to where we came from, and that was his story to us.
Yeah.
So it was good.
Let's move to your recollections of Whitney Young. It was Mr. Young that dispatched both of you to open the office in Birmingham, Alabama. Clarence, can you tell us about Whitney Young, please?
Well, I had known Miss Young a bit before I went to Birmingham. He had gone to college with a cousin of mine at Kentucky State. I've been working for the Urban League about 2 years before I went to Birmingham, in Chicago, running a program of the Urban Leagues in education, integrating schools. Ms. Young had gone to the Urban League in 1961 after being the dean of a school of social work in Atlanta. He hired me 3 years, 4 years after he became the executive director of the Urban League. I knew him, but I'd known a number of people like Mr. Young who were born into middle-class black families whose parents had been in education, who had been reared to take advantage of every opportunity in education to ready themselves for full participation in society. I admired him. He was a man of great stature, a man who made his point without having to be either a bully or a confronter of any kind. I respected him. I understood that at the time he took the helm of the Urban League was going through some moments of change. It was just beginning to become an agency involved in the heightened civil rights movement, working in community organization. In fact, Mr. Young brought a program to the Urban League called the New Thrust, which was a parallel experience in the Urban League, that of working with companies to get jobs and to get education, a parallel experience that of working with communities, to organize communities and to train communities as to how to take advantage of the new laws and the new powers that were available to them. He was a great man. He was a great man.
We're running out of time here. Willard Walker, in just a few words, describe your recollection of Whitney Young.
Very prepared, professional, like a lot of men in my hometown also, black men, but really great character, and he knew what he was doing. He really knew what he was doing.
Well, Clarence Wood and Willard Walker were the founding directors of the Birmingham Urban League in the 1960s. Thank you both very much for sharing your memories with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you can hear more of Mr. Walker's story tomorrow night as he'll take part in a panel discussion at WKAR's community cinema screening of Power Broker, Whitney Young's Fight for Civil Rights, the newest documentary from PBS's Independent Lens. The event is at 7 p.m. at the Communication Arts and Sciences Media Auditorium here at 404 Wilson Road on the MSU campus. The documentary airs on WKAR-TV Monday, February 18th at 10 p.m. John Madden is Associate Professor of Music, Associate Director of Bands, and Director of the Spartan Marching Band at Michigan State University. That was John calling out the tunes for the Spartan Brass at the Breslin Center. He supervises all athletic bands at MSU. Professor Madden and the Spartan Brass will be embedded in the Izzone tonight as the Spartans square off against the Michigan Wolverines in Big Ten basketball action. WKAR's Peter Worf joined John Madden on the Breslin Center floor before last week's win over Minnesota. Peter and John looked ahead to the coming March Madness and talked about Spartan Brass performances at football and basketball rivalry games.
The musicianship, I think, is the same. And, you know, this is about a 100-piece band here in Breslin. 90 of these kids are in the Spartan Marching Band, so they just carry that Spartan tradition over into it, but they know the differences.
What's the difference, if there is, in intensity between the pre-conference games and then as we get into the conference, as we get into the Michigans, the Indianas, the Ohio States, and as we approach March Madness?
Well,
what do you feel different?
It's interesting. I think there's a real palpable difference with those games. You know, it's very similar to marching band, is that when the band is in the stands at Spartan Stadium, we're like a big pep band. When we're on the field, obviously, we're a whole different unit, but we carry that pep band component, so we feel the energy in the stands in Spartan Stadium. That same feeling exists here, and now we're amping up the games. Now we're talking protect your home court. You know, we got to protect, and it's plus the Spartan Brass is embedded right into the heart of the Izzone, so they're part of the Izzone. They're part of the student section. In this case, they just play their instrument and ride that wave of energy.
I think you can imagine how the basketball team prepares and executes the protection of its home court.
Yep.
How does the band do that?
Oh, I think, you know, you bring your A game sort of like a player does. There is an A game for the band. There is a game face for the band. You know, and so you feel it. And if you're kind of in the swarm here and you don't have it, your peers around you will sort of pull you along the way and get you there. So, and I think that goes for everybody in the Izzone too. There's a tangible difference. You can feel it and see it on their face. The students across the board at Michigan State love this basketball team, and they help support that ride that they know they're trying to take.
John Madden is Director of Athletic Bands at Michigan State University. John, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Peter. Thanks for having me.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
7 seconds left. Summers, Locust, the jump shot. Got it!
And a gutsy call, and I like it, by Tom Izzo.
Well, tell me your thoughts. Michigan State came out hard. They competed. But Michigan was the aggressor in this game, and that was the difference in victory.
For Michigan, Chris Webber, James Boswell, Jawan Howard, Jalen Mills, and Michael Talley. As you see, Matt Steginger back for Michigan State in the lineup. He missed the only game of his career against Purdue last week. Dwayne Stevens, Mike Poplowski, Martin Montgomery, and Sean Rushford. Fire it up, Greg. This is going to be a big one.
It's not a series that should be dominated probably by either squad, because both teams should be good. Both teams are good this year. I don't think there's any question that, in my estimation, this is their best team in a lot of years. They are solid in just about every position, and it should make for a heck of a game.
The eighth-ranked Michigan State University men's basketball team plays number 4 Michigan tonight at 9 at the Breslin Center. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Is provided by Douglas J. with 2 Lansing area salon locations, the Okemos Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for Valentine's Day. DouglasJ.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu.